the problems I am going to speak about actually affect many parts of physics, not only particle physics, but also nuclear physics, atomic physics, laser, solid state physics, and so on, up to cosmology. And but you know, in high energy physics, we have since about 1972 are dealing with the standard model of particle physics. And I don't like this name in particular, but to me it was called. As you well know, it is a gauge theory. It's very similar to the very successful gauge theory of quantum electrodynamics. And the gauge group in that case, however, is not like U1 in QED, but it's SU2 times U1 times SU3 for the strong interactions based on the gauge theory of quarks and gluons. The SU2 times U1 theory was introduced first by Shelley-Glasgow in 1964, but then supplemented with the idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking by Steven Weinberg, and 1 year later by Abdus Salam. And SU2 times U1 theory has the feature that it unifies the electromagnetic and the weak interactions, but since it's SU2 times U1, as a gauge theory, SU2 itself wouldn't work. You have not only the two weak currents, but there's also, besides the electromagnetic current, there is a neutral current. And that was for a long time an obstacle, because the experimentalists didn't find evidence for neutral currents. Many reasons why they took it seriously. But then finally it was discovered in CERN in 1972 that the neutral currents exist. That gave a lot of boost for that theory. The SU2 times U1, the SU3 color theory was introduced by myself and Murray Gell-Mann. Here's actually Gell-Mann. There's a picture taken in Berlin when he was giving a lecture in Berlin about 10 years ago. And we introduced that gauge theory in 1972. The standard model has one big problem, still completely unsolved, namely how to understand the fundamental constants of physics. For example, even the very old constant already introduced in the 17th century by Isaac Newton, the constant of gravity, the first constant ever introduced. But today, besides Newton's constant, we have now 27 other constants, so altogether 28. And we still don't know how these constants come into play, how they are generated. Some people, like Murray Gell-Mann, believe that these constants are just some sort of cosmic accidents. And that could indeed be true, at least for some of the constants. It might also be that some of these constants are determined by the dynamical laws of physics, but they must be beyond the standard model. And beyond the standard model, we still don't understand very much. The experiments are more or less consistent with the standard model. And it might also be that some of the constants, or perhaps all of them, are actually not constant at all, but show a slow time variation. Now we speak about it in about half an hour. But what about cosmic accidents? If you have a Big Bang, when I was a little kid, I took this picture when the Big Bang happened, 14 billion years ago. Don't ask me where I got the camera from at that time. And that is the picture I'm supposed to look. But in the Big Bang, the fundamental constant, like the electron mass or the Fraenkel constant alpha or Newton's constant, they, according to dynamical laws which we still don't understand, they very likely fluctuated, they changed all the time. And only when the universe has a critical size, let's say 1 meter, size of 1 meter or something like this, then all of a sudden they are nailed down to particular values. That's what Gell-Mann calls a cosmic accident. Now, if they are cosmic accident, one probably should not speak anymore about the universe, but as many people working in cosmology now do, they speak about the multiverse. I don't quite know what a multiverse really is, but it looks somehow like this, where they have a universe here, here's another one, here's another one, a very small universe is here too. They don't exist for very long. That's the picture they have in their mind in the inflationary universe. I like this picture. It was actually taken out of the last issue of the Discovery magazine, and then the Discovery magazine went in the bankruptcy. it was related to the inflationary universe somehow. But in any case, this is our universe, here is our galaxy, and here in the middle of it is our planet, and then you see also a little bit of Davis over there. And that's the way it looks like. Now, the question is, are the fundamental constants the same everywhere in the universe and at all times? Or maybe they are time variant, or they might also vary in space. That's one of the big questions we have. Now, the second constant introduced into physics was the fine structure constant introduced by Arnold Sommerfeld. And Sommerfeld was a professor of physics in Munich, and was actually my predecessor in the job in Munich. And he took the professorship in Munich after Ludwig Boltzmann had left for Vienna in 1907. And in 1916 he introduced this constant. And you know this constant brings together the electromagnetic interaction in terms of the electric charge, quantum theory in terms of Planck's constant H, and the relativity theory in terms of the speed of light. And just this combination turns out to be a dimensionless number. And the inverse of alpha is very close to the prime number 137. And since that time, a lot of discussion is going on about this number. For example, there was shortly afterwards one of the big survey meetings in Brussels, where the physicists from Europe discussed in great detail Sommerfeld's constant. Sommerfeld himself is standing here. He was a small man. And here you see Rutherford, here is Madame Curie, here is Albert Einstein, and other. Here is Lorentz from Leiden. Leiden, yeah, I think he was in Leiden, and other famous physicists. Wolfgang Pauli also thought a lot about his fine structure constant alpha. He liked to understand that number 137 out of field theory of mathematics, in terms of physical laws, of course. And he couldn't succeed. And you know, he died relatively early in Zurich in the Cantons Hospital in 1958. And one day before he died, he was visited by his previous assistant, Victor Weisskopf, who later on became the director of CERN. And Weisskopf noticed that Pauli was dying in the room number 137. Now, it's probably his own choice. He wanted to die in the room number 137, but we never find out what is the real reason for it. Leon Lederman, also the previous director of Fermilab, he likes also 137. And he lives in 137 in Ola Road. He chose a house on the Fermilab side, it's a big road called Ola Road, and he lives in the number 137. The funny thing about that road is only, on the Ola Road is only one house. That's Lederman's house. So we should better call it number one, but he calls it 137. And many years ago, when I was still at Caltech, Dick Feynman was one of my colleagues, and very often I had lunch with Dick Feynman in the Athenaeum in Caltech, in the lunch place or in the guest house. And we quite often were talking about the number 137. And once Feynman told me, look, you are a theorist, I'm a theorist, we should write on our blackboards 137, how little we know. That would keep us modest. Well, when I came back from that lunch, I went through Feynman's office, and Feynman wasn't in, so I wrote on his blackboard, there was nothing in the blackboard, I wrote in big letters 137, how little Feynman knows. Well, 1 hour later, Feynman came to my office and wrote the same thing, how little Fritsch knows, on my blackboard. Delman didn't like what he had written, but I kept it there for another 3 years until I left Caltech. And Delman was always furious to see that. But you know, the number 137 is really an important number in QED. It describes the interaction, for example, the repulsion of two electrons in this little Feynman diagram. And the interaction of a photon with a fermion is given by the number in the inverse of 137. And this is now the well-known number known today. It was measured only recently with this high precision by Theodor Hensch in Munich. And I will come back to his experiments later. And based on that number, we have developed a theory of QED, which is by far the most successful theory, not only in physics, but in science, I would say. It brings together electrodynamics, special relativity, and quantum theory. And as you well know, it's also renormalizable. That means everything can be calculated, except for one thing, namely the fine structure constant has to be put in, and also the mass of the electron. Unfortunately, we cannot calculate the mass either. But then the rest you can calculate, and it agrees with experiment by one in about 10 million or even better. For example, the magnetic moments of the electron or the muon, or hyperfine splittings of atoms and things like this. But in quantum field theory, it was found out by Gell-Mann and Lohr in 1954 that the coupling constants, like the fine structure constants, are actually not really constants, but they are functions of the energy or of the scale in distance where you do your experiment. So they become functions of the energy. And that has to do with a partial screening of the charges due to electron-positron pairs in the vacuum. For example, if you took here, let's say, a positron, the antiparticle of the electron, the positron surrounds itself with virtual electrons, and the virtual positrons, which are also there in the vacuum, are pushed away. And in that way, the charge is getting partially shielded, and if you have an experiment where you penetrate deep inside, so you can neglect the surrounding, then the coupling constant gets larger. That has been measured in the experiments, at the lab experiments, for example, in Geneva. One was able, just before the lab was closed, to measure the fine structure constant alpha at the highest possible energy so far, 200 GeV. And it was not 1 over 137, but 1 over 127. So quite a bit larger. And the fine structure constant, the very precise mass of the Z boson, about 91 GeV, is measured to be 1 over 127.8. So again, quite a bit larger than 1 over 137, and here it's very precisely known. And it agrees beautifully with the QED theory, with the calculations of Gell-Mann and Lohr. Another thing I like to mention about the fine structure constant has to do with this phenomenon at Oklo. Oklo is a river in the state of Gabon in Western Africa. And there it was discovered that there was a natural reactor, actually several natural reactors going on, about 2 billion years ago. And at that time it was easy to make a reactor, in principle, because there was a relatively high concentration of uranium. The uranium 235 had 3.7%. Today it is down to 0.72% because uranium decays rather slowly. But at that time there was much more uranium-235. And there was also a moderator which you need for a reactor, which was just happened to be the water from the river Oklo. And here you see a picture of Africa. Here in this corner is Gabon. And here is Oklo. And just below Oklo is the city of Lambarene, where the German physician Albert Schweitzer worked for many years. And in the Oklo region, Here is a better picture of the Ugly, well, one of the Google pictures of Western Africa. Here is the Ugly region, with the reactor. Here is the city of Kinshasa, city of Libreville. And the Ugly reactor looks like this. It's underground. One has first discovered four of such active regions, but by now we know 17 of such reactor regions, and they are buried deep inside. And it was discovered accidentally by the French nuclear physicists. They brought uranium from the region of Gabon up to Paris, and they discovered that the uranium-235 in sorry, was too fast. Uranium-235 had less than the normal rate of 0.72%, about 10% less. I wouldn't worry too much about it, but they started to worry. They sent down a group of physicists to investigate what happened, and they discovered this natural reactor, which apparently was going on for more than 100 million years. There was a Russian physicist with the name of Shliapdar, who was from Petersburg and later on went to Harvard. He is still in Harvard, I think, or in MIT. And he pointed out something which was taken up by about 12 years ago by Freeman Dyson and his French collaborator Damour. Namely, the feature that one of the strange elements which are interesting to study is the element samarium. It's one of the rare earth metals. And if you take samarium, which has normally 149 nucleons, and bombard it with neutron, you get samarium 150, and the energy is emitted as a gamma ray. The cross-section for that reaction is huge. It was known to be very huge, much bigger than the typical nuclear physics cross-sections, which are usually in the microbar region, but here we are speaking about kilobar, a huge cross-section. And it was known why that cross-section is so huge, because there is a nuclear resonance just about the threshold for this reaction. It's only 0.1 electron volt above the threshold. And the argument of Schliachter was, since this reaction could be by studying the remains of the reactor in Gabon, in the Ugly region, one could roughly estimate how big this cross-section was at that time. And the argument of Schliachter was that the position of the resonance could not have changed too much, otherwise the cross-section would have been much less. And, the argument which then was brought up by Dyson and Damour is that the change of the resonance position must be less than 0.1 electron volt. And that's an interesting constraint on the electromagnetic interaction, because in the nucleus, if you change the fine structure constant alpha, you change also the position of a resonance. And you can calculate this rather relatively simply. And the conclusion was, that reached by Dyson and Damour, Schliachter didn't have such a good number, that the alpha value at the Ugly times minus the alpha which we see today could not have changed much, but the relative value must be less than 1 in 10 million. And now if you take into account the 2 billion years, in a linear approximation you have to conclude that the change of alpha per year must have been less than 10 to minus 16, which is a very good precision, provided, as pointed out by Dyson and Damour, that no other parameters, like strong direction parameters, have changed at the same time. And this is precisely what might have happened, so this constraint is actually questionable, and we'll come back to this later on. For example, there was a calculation by Flambaum and collaborators in Sydney, in Australia, and also by myself and a graduate student, Carl May, who was also here at Irvine, here in Davis some time ago, I think. Oh, no, he wasn't Irvine, I got it wrong. In any case, the energy change of that resonance is a certain number times the relative change of alpha, But also, if the QCD parameter lambda, the QCD strong interaction parameter changes, or if the quark masses changes, you get another contribution, which is about 10, it's not precisely 10, but about 10, times the change of this quantity, and a larger number times the same ratio with the strange quark mass. So if you have such effects, the conclusion would be there is no limit on the variation of alpha. This 10 to minus 16 could not be taken too seriously. Now, before I return to this, let me speak about other basic parameters in physics. One is, of course, the mass of the nucleon. But this you understand by now. Especially with experiments like here at Stanford in SLAC, where they discovered that the nucleons consist of quarks, just making a deep inelastic scattering on an atomic nucleus, you see the three quarks in the nucleon. And later on at DAISY, they discovered even the quarks come out in terms of jets, so one could see the quarks quite clearly. They are confined particles, but the original momentum of a quark is transferred into the momenta of the pions coming out here, mostly pions. But in this QCD theory, we understand the nucleon mass. It is an effect coming, as Sidney Coleman called it the dimensional transmutation. It has to do with the screening of color and the confinement of the quarks. And the nucleon mass is basically just coming from the quarks and the gluons inside the nucleon moving with high speed. And they cannot move away by more than the critical distance. And the inverse of that critical distance is called 1 over lambda. And lambda is an energy scale. And that has been measured in the experiment to about 250 MeV with large errors still. But in that way, we understand now the nucleon mass. It's really a dynamical quantity. It's dynamically generated by the quarks and gluons. And it describes the nucleon mass very well. The nucleon mass, if you neglect the quark masses, is just given as a constant times this lambda parameter. And that constant, as I mentioned also yesterday, has been calculated in terms of computer calculations and lattice gauge theory to agree with experiment about 2%. That's the experimental value, and it is very well. And in reality, however, the nucleon mass not only gets this QCD term, a constant time lambda, but also terms proportional to the quark masses. And they can be as many views using chiral perturbation theory. And here wouldn't I give this line, I indicate roughly how the numbers go. The QCD part of the nucleon mass is about 860 MeV, 20 MeV from the up and down quarks, 35 from the strange quarks, a little bit of charm, and the pure electromagnetic term of about 2 MeV. So, if you are not a particle physicist, basically you deal in physics only with six fundamental constants. This is the Newton's constant G, for gravity, the mass of the electron, very important for atomic physics, the QCD mass scale, the lambda, and the electromagnetic interaction alpha, and the two masses up and down. And this describes all atomic nuclei, all atoms in the world, all nuclei, everything. But in particle physics, we have to deal with other masses. For example, the W boson masses. And they are, we think at least, produced by a mechanism based on spontaneous symmetry breaking, which I like to call the BEH mechanism from Braudin Anglaire, who wrote the first paper, and then by Higgs in England, who wrote a paper shortly afterwards. It's usually called the Higgs mechanism. In that mechanism, you have a scalar field which generates a mass due to a symmetry breaking, and that scalar field can be viewed in terms of a mechanical potential. Put a little ball in here, and if you have this thing a little bit perturbed, the ball comes down, the rest as here or here or here. And then this ball has a certain distance from the center, and that's what we identify with the vacuum expectation value. And this can be related to the Fermi constant. And the Fermi constant has been measured in the experiments. So we can calculate out of this constant the 246 GeV of the vacuum expectation value. And this is supposed to determine the mass of the W boson. Whether this is right or not, we still don't know. The Higgs particle could be seen at the LHC, the new LHC accelerator in Geneva. Both the Higgs, a single Higgs particle can be produced in the proton-proton collision at these high energies. And if the mass of the Higgs is sufficiently big, it can decay, for example, in the two Z boson. And each Z boson can decay into two muons, a muon and a muon. And that way you would see lots of particles in the collisions, but in particular four muons coming out. And the total mass, if you sum up the energies of the muons, you get the mass of the Higgs. Whether things are so easy, we still don't know. The main problem, however, what we in physics have is to understand the fermion masses. They are still completely obscure. A scalar particle is coming out from the vacuum, and that's in the theory of the Higgs mechanism, and it just has a Yukawa type interaction with a fermion, and that produces electron mass. So the little electron mass of 0.5 MeV is just a very small coupling constant, which you cannot calculate, you have to take it from experiment, times the 246 GeV. As I said also yesterday, I discovered years ago, accidentally, that if you express the mass of the electron in terms of American pounds, it's actually an integer number. It's 2.00 times 10 to the minus 30. And now the, let's see. If you are in particle physics, you have many more fundamental constants. There are the four coupling constants to start with, of course, which you already had. Alpha weak, alpha strong, the normal alpha, and the Newton's constant. When you get a lot of more constants, altogether 14, for the weak interaction, flavor mixing parameters, and also W boson and the Higgs boson mass. But if you include the fermion masses, like electron, muon, and tau, and the three inner masses and the quark masses, you have altogether 28. That's the minimum number we have in the standard model. And 22 of them are directly related to the fermion masses. If you take away all the fermion masses, also the flavor mixing parameters would disappear, and then you are back down to the six parameters which I had before. For the quark masses, I observed already many years ago there is a strange regularity that U to C, the mass of the U divided by the mass of the mass of C and the T seem to be close to the 1/200. And for the charge minus the third, the number is about 1/23. So if you write the quark masses on a logarithmic scale, you get basically a straight line between D, S, and B. And then you could connect also U, C, and T, and then you arrive at the very high mass of 175 GeV for the top quark mass. Based on such a calculation, I predicted the top quark mass already in 1987. Nobody believed me that it's such a big number. Actually, I didn't believe it myself also for a long time. But then it came out about 95, it was discovered at Fermi. Unfortunately, these straight lines don't work with the leptons. The muon is too heavy, as it would have to be here, or the electron is too light. If the electron would be about 5 MeV instead of 0.5 MeV, then it would be okay. Now, normally we assume in the standard model that the fundamental constants are completely universal. That means the same everywhere in the universe, and they do not change in time. But actually, there is not a reason that they are really constant. Not a big reason. For example, now in superstring theories, for example, people discuss extra space dimensions. Now, these space dimensions are called, they are rolled up in little balls, otherwise you would see them. but the size of these balls could easily change. And if that would happen in our world, it would mean a variation of the fundamental constants, or at least some of them. In other words, and also in these theories, you have lots of scalar fields. And the fundamental constants in the superstring theories depend actually on the scalar fields, and these scalar fields could easily vary. So you will get again a variation of the fundamental constants. Also, another thing which is strange about fundamental constants is that they seem to be tuned to our existence. Life, as we see it now, depends on rather strange accidents. For example, as pointed out already by Fred Hoyle many just after the war, that there must be a nuclear resonance of a carbon nucleus if you collide three helium atoms. And he needed this in order to produce helium. If that resonance would not exist, there would be no carbon in our world, or very little carbon. And he predicted it, and then it was, he spoke with Lauritsen at Caltech, and Lauritsen, the two brothers of Lauritsen, made the experiments at Caltech, and they even found that resonance. And if that resonance would not be there, we would not exist. Rather strange. And also, if the coupling constant vary, you could easily understand why we live in our world in such a way that the fundamental constants are just suited for our own existence. Because in other parts of the world, we do not exist, of course, that's clear. And we do not exist because the fundamental constants are different. For example, the fine structure on alpha, if alpha would not be 1 over 137, but 1 over 140, or 1 over 135, a big macromolecule, like this is a protein molecule, it looks rather complicated. This would not exist. It would decay, or it would even not form. So only if alpha is 137, such molecules exist. So the question is, also, is there a time variation of fundamental constants? Dirac was the first one to point out already in 1930 that there could have been a time variation of the Newton's constant G. And he said it should be changed by a factor of 2 to 3 during the lifetime of the universe. In 1930, one didn't know how long the universe existed. People were thinking about 3 million years. But today we know it's about 14 billion years. So according to the hypothesis of Dirac, the change per year in a linear approximation would be roughly 10 to minus 10. And people have looked for such a time variation of G, and they couldn't find anything. But only recently it was excluded that there is a time variation of the order of 10 to minus 10. The present experiments bring it down to 10 to minus 11 per year. That's based on rather precise satellite experiments by the NASA here in the US. But only recently it was finally Dirac's hypothesis was ruled out. Now, what about the time variation of alpha? Well, here there is a positive evidence. The astrophysicists have looked at very distant quasars. Some of them 5 billion years back in time, some of them 12 billion years back in time. And they find some evidence. The way it goes is as follows. Here you have a quasar, and the light from the quasar goes through a gas cloud and then reaches the Earth. And studying this light here, we could see the absorption line of the atoms going through that gas cloud. And then you can compare it with corresponding experiments on Earth and can see whether there is a variation. That has been done actually by Professor Webb in Sydney, Australia, and by Flambaum in Sydney, and by Art Wolf and his collaborators in San Diego, and also by British collaborators. And for example, one of the British collaborators was here, Dishington Berdow. And they looked at the fine structure of elements like iron or nickel in quasars, which are up to 11 billion years back in time. And that's the result they find. The change of alpha is -0.5, published in Physical Review Letters, with a small error, 10 to the -5. If you take into account these 11 billion years, in a linear approximation, it would imply that alpha changes with a rate of 10 to the -15. And this might be too large a number, because I said before, from the Oklo experiment in Africa, the limit was 10 to the -16. That is in disagreement with Oklo. For that reason, I mentioned that it could also be that other parameters change. And this is precisely what I'm going to discuss. But before I do this, let's look at the experiment of that group from Australia and the US. That's the experimental data. Doesn't look too impressive to me, the errors are still quite large, but they conclude from this there is this evidence. The experiment is still going on. There's another experiment now being prepared to check this. I suppose this is right. Then you can discuss it in the, provided there is a grand unification. And let me take as a possible group for grand unification the group SO10. It has been discussed by Peter Minkowski and myself a long time ago in 1975. In the grand unified theory, the three coupling constants for the electromagnetic weak and the strong interactions are unified in one coupling constant. So you might think at the end you have only one parameter instead of three, but that's not true because you also need the energy scale where the unification takes place. That's another parameter. So there, at the end there are two parameters, so you get rid of one constant, so you have only one prediction. And in the SO10 theory, the basic fermions of every family of leptons and quarks are put into a 16-dimensional representation that you see here. This is the electron, this is the positron, these are all left-handed particles. Here are the quarks, the antiquarks, and here in particular is the neutrino. And you see there's also an anti-electron neutrino, which you do not have in the SU5 theory, and also we do not have in the standard model. And so the neutrinos could be Fermi Dirac particles, but in general they would have a mass. And we know now from the experiments that indeed neutrinos have a mass, so that looks quite natural. In the grand unified theory, the three coupling constants converge to a single coupling constant at a huge energy scale of the order of 10 to the 15 GeV. And in SO10, this conversion takes place very nicely. In SU5, unfortunately, it has been ruled out by experiment. So could there be a time change of the fine structure constant? Well, the fine structure constant you have here, this is this line. That's the low energy value. If there is a time fluctuation of the time of the fine structure constant, you can get it either by making a time fluctuation of the unified coupling constant, or at the same time you could also have a time fluctuation of the energy scale where the unification takes place. But whatever you do, in each case, you not only change the fine structure constant, but also the strong interaction coupling constant, also the weak interaction, but the weak interaction is hard to test.
Excuse me, so each of those are more plausible than changing the slope of the running?
The slope of the running is determined by the by the field theory. You cannot change anything. Mm-hmm. That's completely determined by the Riemann-Lowe equations, the Riemann-Sylow group equations. Otherwise, you couldn't get any prediction. And that was calculated by Carl May and myself, and also by Langhager and Segre independently in the States, that based on a grand unified theory like SO10, the relative change of alpha are related to the relative change of alpha strong, and also to a change of the unified coupling constant. Suppose there is no change of the unified energy scale. Suppose there is no change of the unified energy scale, then you have a very simple relationship between a change of alpha and change of alpha strong, just given by a Clebsch-Gorlin coefficient of S10. Actually, just the number of gluons divided by the number of quark colors. 8 divided by 3. And now if you phrase it in terms of lambda, you get about 40, or 39, let's say, times the change of alpha. And that would mean, for example, the magnetic moments of nuclei, or masses of nuclei, would change with a rate of 4 times 10 to the minus 14. Still a very small number, but this is getting sensitive now to the experiments. Now suppose the scale of unifications that changes is not the coupling constant itself. Then you can do the same calculation and you find the change of lambda is again a large number, about minus 31, times the relative change of alpha. So you get now a time change. Before it was plus 40, now it's minus 30. Question is, can we test this by experiments? Well, when I did this calculation in 2002, I didn't think very much about experiments. But then I spoke once with Theodor Hensch, and he gave me lots of details about his experiment, and then I got interested. I knew, of course, that time is measured by cesium blocks. And as you might not know, in the cesium block, you use the hyperfine transition of a cesium atom to measure the second or the time evolution. And that involves, the hyperfine transition involves the magnetic moment of the cesium nucleus. So if you change the QCD scale, this magnetic moment would change just as well. And you get a problem. Normally, we use a cesium block to define time. The definition of time is based on this number. There is not a comma, not a point here, and some other numbers. This is precisely the definition of the second now. 9 billion and some smaller numbers, hertz. That's the definition of time we have. But I realized if there is this change, the time change of lambda QCD, a cesium clock would show a different time behavior as a hydrogen clock. A hydrogen clock is a clock where you use hydrogen transitions, which do not depend on the magnetic moment. They are just normal hydrogen atomic transitions. And these clocks are not used normally in physics. Actually, there's only one of these clocks available right now, and that's the one which was constructed by Theodor Hensch in Munich at the Max Planck Institute for Quantum Optics, the MPQ. And he did a lot of very good experiments with this hydrogen clock, and as you might know, in 2006 he got the Nobel Prize for this discussion, the very good position of alpha, for example. It measured alpha very nicely. But I calculated that every day you depart, there is a discrepancy between the cesium block and the hydrogen block by 3 cesium oscillations per day. Now this is not very much, because in a second you have so many calculations and so many oscillations. So 3 per day is quite a small number. So I didn't think it could be measured. But indeed, it was measured by Hensch. That's the experiments he was doing in Munich. And let me just go back. I forgot something to say. Yeah. Here, in his experiment, he had this as this special laser here for his hydrogen spectrometer, which I call a hydrogen clock. He doesn't like it. Hensch doesn't like the name hydrogen clock. He just calls it a spectrometer. And he took as a reference the best cesium clock we have in the world right now, and that is usually in Paris. It's a clock which even has a name. They call it Pharaoh. You know, and this clock was brought to Munich, and Hensch did already the first experiments with it in 1997. And then he started that new experiment, which I told him to do in 2002 or 2003. how well he can measure it, you see it here. The hydrogen transition, the 1s2s transition of hydrogen, is measured with this incredible precision. The uncertainty is given just by 18 hertz, but the basic frequency is given here. Normally, I wouldn't give it in hertz, but he is able to give it in hertz. That's very well, it's a precision of 10 to minus 15. That's his experiment. Here is the hydrogen. Don't ask me details of that experiment. I've seen it quite often. But the 4 o'clock is here somewhere on the right-hand side. It's a rather big experiment. And it's still going on right now. Since Hensch started the experiment in Munich, now also at the laser people in the American Laser Institute in Boulder, Colorado, started to do the same experiment. Now, what Hensch was measuring, it's published in Physical Review Letters, is a change of the change of the magnetic moment of the cesium nucleus with this precision. Not very good, you know, 2 plus minus 7 times 10 to minus 15. But it's 10 to minus 15. I had predicted in the simplest model the change is 2 times 10 to minus 14. And that is certainly now excluded by his measurements. So the question is, what can we do? Maybe the whole thing is wrong. But then we had in Munich at the Max Planck Institute a visitor from Princeton, which you probably know, Edward Witten. And he studied also this possibility. He studied my equation, which I had before. And he said, I could reshuffle the equation by putting the change of alpha on the right-hand side and the alpha strong on the left, and compare on the change of the unification scale here on top of it. And then he started this thing in the superstring theories. And the conclusion of Witten and collaborators was that in superstring theories we would naturally expect that these two terms are of the same order of magnitude, and the sign is undetermined. The sign could either be positive or negative. But suppose there is a negative sign here, and this term is as big as this one. In this case, the effect for alpha strong would be reduced, and so you could have time change of alpha strong, but with a reduced rate. Not 2 times 10 to minus 14, but let's say a few times 10 to minus 15, or even less. Well, when I realized this, I called up Hensch again and told him he should start a new experiment to look now for an effect maybe at a smaller rate. So he did this again. It's still going on right now. It's unpublished. But the preliminary result of Hensch is given here. He finds a change of the QCD scale of the order of 3 times 10 to minus 15, so about a factor of 9 less than I had predicted. The error is still quite large. He's going to publish it when the error comes down to something like 0.3. It might take another year or 1.5 years from now. And what is interesting is that at the same time, actually 2 years ago, there is a Dutch group guided by Professor Reinhold. I forgot whether he's from Amsterdam or any of these universities in Holland. And he did an experiment at the Chile telescope, with the European telescope in Chile, looking at 2 quasars, both of them very far away, 12 billion light years. And he looked not for a time variation of alpha, but for a time variation of the proton mass divided by the electron mass. You can do this by looking at hydrogen, the fine structure of hydrogen transitions. And that's what he finds. For the mass ratio. Mu is now the mass ratio, proton divided by electron mass. Now it could be that the electron mass is time variant, but if you place the time variation on the QCD scale and we keep the electron mass constant, then that would give an information about the time variation of the QCD scale, and it is of the same order as what Hensch finds. What Reinhold finds is this change again, 3 times 10 to minus 15, and that's what Hensch is also finding in his laser experiment. I checked also that in both experiments, there is a sign. Could either be positive or negative. But the sign is in both cases is positive. So the same sign. So it seems to be the same effect. And hence, Hensch is very interested in this. He keeps now good contact with Reinhold. But he claims now he can find the same effect in the laser experiment. Now, if suppose this is true, it would imply that all masses, in particular, of atomic nuclei would slowly shift in time. We would not be time and not be constant in time. And that brings me already to my summary. It would be an interesting effect. We have 28 constants of nature in the standard model, and 24 of them are just mass parameters. 22 fermion masses, and then you have the nucleon mass and the W boson mass. The grand unified theory relates the electromagnetic strong and the weak interactions. And the time variation of the QED alpha, that according to the grand unification, would lead to a time variation of the QCD scale and the weak interaction scale. The weak interactions cannot be tested with high precision, so very little is known about it, but the QCD is very well known, of course. At the Max Planck Institute, one did this experiment comparing the hydrogen clock with the cesium clock, and the simplest model was ruled out by this experiment, but there seems to be an effect by the factor of 10 less than the naive expectation, and that's consistent with this observation of Reinhold looking at the electron-proton mass ratio. But in order to have this, you need both the unification scale changing and the unified coupling constant. And that's precisely what happens in the superstring series. So the QCD scale would change in time and the fine structure constant, and therefore the masses of atomic nuclei would change in time. So the conclusion might be that all fundamental constants of physics are eventually functions of time, even the electron mass and the neutrino masses. And that has lots of consequences, in particular for cosmology, for nuclear synthesis and cosmological models and so on. Here again you see the inflationary universe, and the fundamental constants are very likely just cosmic accident produced right at the Big Bang for each of these universes. There are many Big Bangs, of course, if you have many universes. And it's finished now. So some of these fundamental constants are probably, as Kalman says, just cosmic accidents. And there's no reason to believe that you can calculate things like the fine structure constant alpha. Just cosmic accidents, and probably depend on time. But the time variation, of course, is still very uncertain. So thanks a lot for your attention.
So, of course, in your simple grand unification equation, you were implicitly, I guess, assuming that the contributions to the mass of the nuclei and what have you from the up and down quarks were constant, but that those were changing. Is that right?
They would also change.
In general, you would add more terms and you could have lots of possibilities. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so you could have all kinds of balances going on to give you the right number. But it is interesting that the two experiments, which I guess test these things in different ways, or consistently simple model.
Yeah. And we are waiting now for the results coming out of Boulder. Mm-hmm. Boulder maybe also doing the same. You usually do the same thing what Hensch is doing. Because Hensch is the best laser physicist in the world. And whatever he does is now redone by the people in Boulder. And but he has a very good hydrogen spectrometer. And he's the only. The one in Boulder is not so good. The one of Hensch is extremely good. A very expensive machine, a huge machine.
Yeah.
And Hensch was planning to take this machine back to Stanford, since they offered him to return to Stanford, since he was retired in Munich. But now he got the Nobel Prize and he was allowed to stay in Munich. So he keeps it in Munich and doesn't go to Stanford. He might go in 3 years, but when he reaches the age of 68,
totally
absolute
cutoff or something.
There's a cutoff, and he might go to Stanford in 3 years from 2 years from now. He's now 66, but he still looks like 32. Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of, or you described some astrophysical measurements that shed some light onto some of these questions. Can you envisage other cosmological observation that could be done that would give further information on some of these?
Yeah, probably there are. I didn't think too much about it. But for example, studying nuclear synthesis in more detail, one gets also some information on time evolution of these parameters. But the way I understand it now, from nuclear synthesis, you don't get such a precise value as Hensch is getting from his experiment. But on the other hand, nuclear synthesis is sensitive to the first years or first hours of the universe, very close to the Big Bang. And at that time reaction might have been much bigger. I would expect this. So any information which is, let's say, better than 10% or so would already be interesting. And some people are working on these problems. But I don't know the details. But certainly in cosmology, lots of things could be done in the future about it.
You know what the most sensitive thing might be, according to people who are looking at this? I mean, there's the imprint on the CMB that probably isn't sufficiently precise. I don't know, what would be sufficiently precise, potentially?
No, see, I don't know. The CMB is just electromagnetic things.
It might give you a grip from the nucleosynthesis and what have you, and it's lighter.
I discussed it with some expert at some point, like Mukhanov in Munich, and the conclusion was that nuclear synthesis and these related things do not give precision by more than something like 20-30%.
Yeah, that's what I might guess.
Yeah. So it's very difficult. But there might be other things one could think about. And but I'm not a cosmologist. So I'm not a precisionist. I was already surprised that Hensch from laser physics. Hensch is all of a sudden interested in particle physics. He never was more in about particle physics. Now he goes to CERN and discusses things with the theoreticians at CERN. And very funny.
You talked about these observations by Beck, but Chand and Sweenan did the same thing, about the same sensitivity, and didn't see anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was a Russian observation about a year ago that did see a change in the fine structure constant at about the same magnitude, but with the opposite sign.
Yeah, this is correct. I didn't mention it. There is a experiment done by French people in Paris, and also some Russian experiment, and they give conflicting results. And the one in France doesn't give any change, but the errors are quite large, nevertheless, in those experiments. And the error by Webb is relatively small. So people are discussing it. And for that reason, now in the States, there is a new experiment being prepared to check this. And Art Wolf and Webb are redoing the experiment at the Keck telescope again to check. And I don't know what the outcome might be. I'm a bit worried that John Barrow, I mentioned him before, is a member of that group. And he is a theoretician. And he wrote a book even about it. He likes time-dependent constants. I mean, fundamental constants not being constants, but functions of time. He likes this. And he might have convinced his colleagues to publish it a little bit too early. And maybe something, some things are not quite correct in that experiment. I spoke about it with Webb when I was in Sydney, Australia last year, but Webb said no, Barrow had no influence in this, but I'm not so sure. Art Wolf told me the same thing in San Diego.
This we have to do. New result that came out within the past month or so that I'm trying to remember about. I thought it was about the nuclear masses, but maybe it's the magnetic moments that the
No, magnetic moment are just as well as the masses itself. If you find any change here.
So there's a new paper.
And one should also try to repeat this experiment of Reinhold. With him. He claims he found this correct time change. It would be very, quite interesting. And so far no other experiment has been done. It's very difficult to see two quasars 12 billion years ago, with 12 billion light years away. And to look for hydrogen transitions in these quasars. For my taste, this is too difficult, but they somehow seem to be able to get some information out of it. The error he finds is relatively small. It might indeed be correct. But Hensch has certainly the best way to check it. And he claims in the next 3 years he will improve his sensitivity from 10 to minus 15 to 10 to minus 18. So he could measure a time change of QCD lambda within, let's say, 1% precision. That would be extremely good information to get this way. He might get a second Nobel Prize for this. He got only 1/3 of the Nobel Prize, so he could get another 1/3 perhaps. Yeah.
Questions? Okay, well, let's thank Harold again.